Pranam, all welcome. Let's invite our dear Jiva and Prabhu to share a few words of blessing.
Hare Krishna, dear brothers and sisters. I'm so grateful that we get this chance today to be in this space to explore the ever ongoing journey of love, of divine love, and our connectedness to everything. Hare Krishna.
So, with those words, with that Mangala Charan, we inaugurate our gathering today. Welcome to you all, Pranam, and greetings from La Verna in Italy. We've been just finished our retreat, our exploration, our pilgrimage with a group of 35 pilgrims or so, brothers and sisters from all around the globe who came to meet Saint Francis at the place of his stigmata, who came to rediscover their connection with Sriman Mahaprabhu, who came to with the intention of, refreshing, renewing, recalibrating our place in the world, our place in ourselves, and our place in relationship to others, and how exploring how sister traditions can enlighten the tradition we feel most at home with. So I will say the experience was beautiful. I'm talking for myself, but also I dare to talk for everyone else since we have a very beautiful sharing also last afternoon. And it was clear that it was a very nourishing time. And hopefully those of you who couldn't participate in 3D at least somehow had the chance of having a glimpse through some of the sharings that we did, at least the morning sharings. Soon we will be also sharing some pictures and some of the kirtans and other things that we had these days. So today is more like a resting day. Almost everyone already left to their particular places. And tomorrow, personally, I'm returning to Rome for a few days. And next week we'll be meeting. I will be in Switzerland by that time. So welcome, welcome, welcome. And as usual, you are invited to bring to our conversation, to our ongoing exploration, any questions, any topics, any quests, any exploration you would like to dive into today that feels necessary, that feels urgent, maybe that feels unsettling and terrifying as well, or inspiring and nourishing, and all that put together, and all the things in between that. Whatever it is, feel free to bring it, feel free to be yourself, as we are all trying to do the same over here. So you can raise your digital hand as usual, and we will eventually trying to honor your offering. Or if you don't know how to raise your hand, you can raise physical hand or send a written message via the chat in Zoom. So far I'm seeing two digital hands raised, one by Silpa Karini and the other one by Manjulali Manjari. So we'll start with Silpa Karini. You can unmute yourself. Welcome.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, Hare Krishna to everyone. This is probably the question that been asked many times, and I got that answered many times. But today, I was listening and to a class or to a thing from Narayan Maharaj where he said about offenses against devotees, and we heard that so many times, but somehow or other, it just kind of really didn't disturb me, but it made me afraid again. Even I'm knowing I heard answers about that so many times, but I'm just still getting afraid that, I had recently some things with devotees which I don't get along. It's nothing really bad, just normal human interaction, I guess. And it just makes me really afraid that then I can chant till millions of life and I will not make any advancement or so. And it just keeps coming, this is just doesn't go away kind of thing.
So,
Yeah, so maybe you
what
can
do you
say no,
want me
it's not
to
so,
do?
I don't know. Maybe you can say it's not so bad and maybe it's not like that or so.
Okay. Thank you. So, well, course, I don't know what you've read in particular in detail, and I don't think there's need to go to the details of what's been said. And it goes beyond what has been said and whomever has been said and however one has understood it, because there's always what's said and how we receive it and what's sometimes triggered in us. Many times it's a mixture of facts, right? As they say, at least in Argentina, when we get triggered, and maybe the person was the trigger, no, or what the environment, what happened in the environment, whether it's just someone saying or doing something, but also probably the powder is inside of us to some degree at least. So we have to also own our own case and pay attention to, okay, what's being triggered in me and why. Not to deny that sometimes things can be done and said from the outside, from the environment, in ways that can be harmful, which again, in this case, I cannot speak for that because I don't have the details of anything. But of course, coming from someone like Srila Narayana Maharaj, whom I consider a deep sadhu, I won't consider that something harmful. I'm mostly thinking, again, it goes beyond the specifics of the case. I'm mostly thinking about what we were, as you said, perennial question, perennial topic, certain things being expressed in ways that we may feel triggered in terms of, I don't know, feeling hopeless or feeling threatened or feeling intimidated or feeling scared or feeling like, I don't know, at any moment I can make an offense and hell is just ready waiting for me at every single moment, right? Like the doors of damnation are always open, ready to swallow me at the slightest mistake I make. And then we practice bhakti from a place of deep neuroticism, to say the least, which of course is not the idea, no? Which of course is not the intention. Sometimes things are framed negatively, or sometimes we are being cautioned about certain things, but it's always important to understand the broader picture, or even in some cases, again, I'm talking in general, in some cases, understand the particular language that each person uses in their own culture, the particular ways of emphasizing something in a particular background or language or country, which in some countries that be normal and may not trigger neuroticism, and some other country may do. And we may need to reframe things in ways that are more digestible to our, let's say, the Western DNA without compromising the essence of the teaching. There is a place for that. And again, with this, we are not saying one culture is better than the other. No wanted to play that triumphalist card. But in brief, what I will say is whenever we hear, and that's all over, it's not about whatever you read or heard by Srila Narayana Maharaj, it's all over in Shastra, and every sadhu that I know may have talked about it, cautioning us regarding Vaishnava Aparad. But the main intention there, again, as we always say, Aparad means that which goes against love. And a Vaishnava or a sadhu is someone who basically embodies love. So Vaishnava Aparad basically means to attack the embodiment of love, or to go against the embodiment of love. So we are being cautioned about that, not so much because of the terrible hellish consequences that wait for us, but just because we are on the path of bhakti. If we are on the path of bhakti, which I assume we are, or we are trying to, and we want to pursue love, so the most coherent thing will be probably you will try to do all the things that support your pursuit of love. You will try to embrace love in all its ways in the most favorable way possible. Therefore, those things which directly oppose that, well, we will be cautioned about, and sometimes strongly, just in case. Sometimes we may need some extra shaking, but again, it's not so much about making us afraid or making us like frozen and paralyzed whenever we are relating to a sadhu. No, like, okay, I will try to be as careful as possible not to commit an offense. It's not so much from that place. Again, if we have the heart in the right place, a sincere intention, And we want to relate to not only to a sadhu, to anyone, but including a sadhu. You know? And by sadhu, we always define what's a sadhu, not necessarily like a pure, devotee, immaculate, Mahabhagavat, enlightened being, yes, but also whomever embraces authenticity as their path. So if I'm related to someone who is authentic, the main currency there will be my own authenticity, as imperfect, as flawed as it may be. And in one sense, that warrants there is no offense, and there is no apparat, there's no going against love. So basically, that's the idea. If we are sincere and authentic in our attempt to pursue the bhakti path, and maybe it may sound too light for some, but I would say, if we are honest and sincere in our pursuit of bhakti path, there are basically no chances to commit apparat. Right. Apparat is like an intentional action, going against love in a conscious way. So if I'm sincere and transparent and trying not to do that, and I'm trying to walk the path of love as transparently as I can, that immediately protects me from all of that. As Srila Samraj will say, sincerity is invincible, which is another way of putting that in his own words, right? If I'm sincere, success is warranted, victory is warranted. There's nothing that will defeat me. So it's basically that. I would say, a call for coherence. You want love, then you will avoid all the things that go against love. It's just, in one sense, basic common sense, right? And if I know that there are agents of love, there are people who are embodying their love, who embody that love, who are trying to live their life in synchronicity with that love, I will be careful in a healthy way to honor those embodiments. But again, not from a place of neuroticism, not from a place of, because if those people are embodiments of love, again, they won't be completely angry at us and cursing us, and at the minimum mistake, they will like just invoke in Sudarshan Chakra or whatever. Right? We are not to abuse that, of course. Oh, they're embodiments of love, so I can mistreat them. They are merciful. That's not the point. But the point is, if I'm sincere and honest, even if I have some shortcomings, a real sadhu will see that the sincerity on top of any other shortcoming, and there will be always, compassion, understanding, forgiveness, whatever needs to be invoked. And therefore, we should, the topic of apparat at that point stops being part of the conversation. Again, I don't want to take up, to put apparat in, to make it disappear completely, but then just want to emphasize, on top of apparat, aparada is radha, no? It's love, it's a personification of love. So if we are trying to be loving in our connection, to be honest, open, sincere, that automatically protects us from aparada. We don't need to make a separate effort to try to counteract aparada, to try to be aware of checking all the boxes. I'm not committing aparada one, aparada two, aparada three, aparada four, aparada five. If I'm relating to you, while in my mind thinking, okay, am I committing the fifth namapara, the seventh, the eighth? I'm not there with you. I'm somewhere else. And probably by being so absent, in one way that goes against love. Yeah. In one sense, that's apparat, but apparat not like this heavy, charged word that sometimes has been weaponized by through decades, that feels like an eternal branding on our soul that will never leave its stain. No, that's not apparat. So I would say, the main thing to be protected from apparat is to be not so much obsessed with avoiding apparat, but being obsessed in a healthy way to offering ourselves in relationship with sincerity and affection and vulnerability and transparency. That automatically take everything else, it takes care of itself. That's how it works. Not so much to be concentrated primarily on avoiding the negative. That's always primarily on having the positive in place. That's why, I don't know, in Saranagati, there are six expressions. The first one, Anukulyas Sankalpa, And only then comes Pratikulyasavarjana, which means first comes accept all that is favorable, positive, and then reject what is unfavorable, which in many ways it just takes care of itself by you embracing the positive. So yeah, it makes me think like when we shared some maybe months ago, a few months ago, I shared a link from written the 10 namaparads, the 10 things that go against love in connection to the name, as reframing a positive language. You know, maybe Bhaktarasa can look for that and share the link in the chat section. Maybe you have seen that. Those were written by Jagadananda Prabhu, a friend of mine. He already passed. And yeah, that was beautiful. And that was very interesting because last year, I think when I was in Germany, someone asked the same question. And we kind of went through the different namaparads and reframed them in a positive language, invoking like a positive attitude, all in the context of taking honoring love, serving love, tending the necessities of love, not so much not doing things. Like I like to do also when reframing what's sometimes known as the four regulative principles, which are not about not doing things. It's all about doing something deeply positive with our lives, in our relationships. It's very, very relational. So the same with this. So see, sometimes we find some strong wording, strong caution about do not offend the Vaishnavas because if you do this or that. Also, some other thing that we also mentioned many times, especially I mentioned that when dealing with the topic of the hellish planets mentioned in the Bhagavad and in other places, that many times scripture or even the sadhus may use a language that sounds more like, that may sound like they want to make you afraid of something. Not because they are bad, but just because some people are in a certain stage that only will only stop doing certain things that are damaging to themselves if they receive some strong warnings with a clear depiction of the consequence of that, which even sometimes may be a little exaggerated to stop them from doing all that nonsense. But that may not apply to us, and it's okay. I myself sometimes read sections from scripture or discourses from personalities which are in that direction, a little bit too much on the heavy leaning toward, if you do this, this will happen. And I understand the context of that, the purpose of that, but I don't feel that it's nourishing for my particular stage. I don't need to erase the verse, edit the lecture. I just understand it goes for certain people. I've been that people. I may be that people again. I don't know. I hope not. But it has a purpose with certain audience in mind. That's the main. We talked about that in our introduction to the Srimad Bhagavatam, and we gave some months ago. Sukadev Goswami is talking primarily to Parikshit Maharaj. But there are many other people in the audience. So some sections of the Bhagavatam will be mostly spoken with that other people in mind, not necessarily with the pure bhakti that Parikshit Maharaj is after. So it's important to discern the things, and sometimes we will find expressions that we may not relate to. We don't need to discard them altogether for everyone. We don't need to criticize that. We don't need to have a wrong impression. We don't need to be triggered, hopefully. We just need to understand that has a purpose. For some time, place, circumstance, people may not have a purpose for me. Okay, then how to speak about this same theme, whatever it may be, in a way that is not, we are not downplaying or diluting the topic, but it's relatable, it's relevant, it's nourishing, inspiring, and it's challenging in a healthy way that invites me to grow. So that's an example, right? Like recalibrating the nama parad, which include Vaishnava parad, in ways that make us understand actually it's all about loving the Vaishnavas. Then Bhaktarasa shared the file there, I think. So let me open it 1 minute just to give you an example of what we were talking about. So for example, it starts saying, if Radha is love, all love her shadow, no love can be any other. So the first great sin against love, my friends, is not to love the lover. So it's just to give you an example how it's the depiction of Vaishnava Parad, no? We want to love. So there are sins against love. And again, sins could be missing the mark. missing the mark of what it means to love. And it makes sense. Okay, to not love the lover. It's beautiful, beautifully put. It's not even, of course, we can say to kill a Vaishnav, no, to harm a Vaishnav, which of course that's also part of that. But to not love the lover, it's in one sense it's even more challenging. Because I may say, I'm not killing any Vaishnav, I'm not going through life insulting Vaishnavas or lovers of God. I'm not, but are you loving them? No. So when you bring the full positive implication of that, it's in one sense even more challenging than just abstaining from doing certain things. You follow my point? So, like I gave these depictions of the four regulative principle. One would say, do not eat meat. It's negative. It can lead a don't orientation to life, which in itself created some problems. But it's relatively easy in one sense. Oh, I'm already vegetarian. I'm fulfilling that principle. No. The principle is ahimsa, nonviolence. Broader than that, in a positive formulation, is be kind, be loving, and on top of that is be as kind and loving as you can. But that's way more challenging. Be as kind and loving as you can in potential. Then do not eat meat. So you have now a positive formulation, which is healing you from the trauma, so to say, of seeing things only in terms of don'ts. But now you find yourself with a big new challenge, which is, oh my gosh, the actual rule was to be as loving, as caring as I can. And even I don't know how loving and caring I can be in potential. It's a mystery. So let's explore that mystery. So the same with this idea, no, of the first Vaishnava Parad. It's not so much do not offend the Vaishnavas. Do not offend. And it's not only the Vaishnavas. Again, by Vaishnav here, we mean any genuine embodiment of love. So do not, it's not do not kill, do not insult. It's love the lover. It's like, oh, that's a deeper invitation. Because again, I can somehow manage not to kill Vaishnavas, right? I hope we can manage that one. Right. I hope we can manage not to become serial killers in the Gaudiya community. I hope. But still, that's very, very basic, no? Like we were talking the other day about different levels of religious, inter-religious exchange. In the beginning, it was people couldn't talk to one another centuries ago, and they will kill one another just because you are from a different religion. Then came religious tolerance. No? Do not, I tolerate you. I don't kill you. Okay, that's we are progressing. But still, I'm not loving you. I'm just tolerating you. I'm just tolerating the temptation to kill you. I'm not indulging in my temptation. Like making a parallel, right? Then on a deeper level, okay, I can appreciate some of your teachings, but do I love you? Am I opening myself to love all the lovers of love, all the lovers of God in all its forms? That's a way deeper invitation. And that's the ultimate implication of do not commit Vaishnava Parad. Again, it's not do not commit Vaishnava Parad. It means love the lovers of love. And then we are thrown into a pool of potential. What does mean? What does it mean for me to love the lovers of love? How much can I love? How deep can I love? That's an endless exploration, right? So those will be for me the implications when we play out the implications of what Vaishnava Parad means. Hopefully we all converge always in a positive note, which is not only positive, but also challenging enough for us to continue pursuing that positiveness forever, instead of just seeing it in the negative, checking the box, thinking I'm not doing that, or what even worse, traumatizing ourselves, I may do that at any moment, and we froze in time and we become quite dysfunctional in our relationships. Ideally, we have to hopefully, yeah, pass through those stages and converge in this beautifully open, challenging invitation to love the lovers, with all that it entails. Yeah. Bhadra is making a comment. If you bow down with only one hand on the floor, watch out for this one, you will lose all your bhakti sukriti. What if I had an accident and I only have one hand, right? That's a problem. You have to put a fake one so you don't commit offense. Again, all those types of things come from a more formulaic, fear-oriented mentality, which again, many people start there or are there in some point of their journey. There's a place for that. No, that's not the end place, the final resting place. But we should understand that with compassion. But also, if we clearly do not feel comfortable there, it means we are called to something else. And hopefully we can gradually get closer and closer to this final call, where it's the final invitation, the final version. We have to reach this point of the final irreducible way of saying the things that you cannot say it in any other way, but that final irreducible way of saying those things present you enough challenge to continue growing in that for eternity. No? So the final way to say this is love the lovers of love. That could be a final sutra. You don't need to you cannot get more positive than that. And that leaves you at a place where you can always grow in that one line forever. There's no limit to how much you can love those who love. There's no end to that. So you found a final version of that first Vaishnavapura in this case, which is reframed in a totally positive way. And we have homework for the rest of forever. So speaking about homework, now I invite you to the breakout rooms so you can have your breakout, breakdown, breakthrough, break open, and discussion together in intimate circles about the importance of reframing the things and how do you feel about this particular reframing of rather than thinking, do not do that because this will happen, what it means to love the lovers of love and what it means for us. So yeah, we'll go there for a few minutes, then we return. So far, we have only one more raised hand by Manjulali Manjari or Elijah. We'll see in a few minutes. But of course, if someone else has any raised hand when we return from the breakout rooms, feel free to raise your hand also for me to have an idea how many offerings we have today. Okay, see you in a few moments. Welcome. Welcome back. Let me read the room, read the face. Okay, seems you had a good time. You had some fun over there in the Zoom caves, private meeting hall. So, welcome back. Hoping you had some nourishing further reflection on the need of conceiving it all from a not only positive but also deeply committing, ever-evolving way. So again, if there is any other further questions or requests or explorations, you're invited to raise your digital hand. I'm seeing now also Gaurachara and Tapan and Nandini raising their hand, one of them. But of course, we'll go first, honoring the original cue to Manjulali, Manjari, and Elijah. So you can unmute yourself. Welcome.
Hare Krishna. I'm just going to put this out there. I'm not someone that usually asks questions, but I know I've asked about three now, so I do feel quite terrified when I ask the question. Anyway, I'll try and express this.
Hopefully you don't commit any Vaishnava
Well, I
apparat
know. I know. It might be quite difficult for me to express this one, but I'm just thinking, actually, it's a continuation from the previous question in a way. And it was around the pastime of Jad Bharat. And thinking that, when you're reading that pastime, in a sense, you are positioned as a third person, if you like, because you're able to see the different perspectives. In a sense, we have a more all-knowing perspective than the dacoits or the king. So I'm thinking about that, the range of many different perspectives on reading it, and how when we're in that position, we're able to see, gosh, the dacoits have completely misread who Jad Bharat is, and King Rahugana again has also got it wrong, it would seem. So we have that kind of open, broad perspective on what's going on, but then, we can close the book, slip into the pages of our own life, and very quickly become quite closed, and not being curious when we meet people or other devotees, and sometimes also being on the receiving end where someone is, I don't know, just interacting with you in a way that's based on lots of different, their perception of who you are, and it's not really a reflection of reality. So, but also, I guess, just thinking about the pastime from the perspective of, othering people with difference, or, and how even in society now, isn't it, people who are a bit different or whatever are othered and marginalized, and all kinds of assumptions are made. And then also, I guess, that position of complete acceptance when Jad Barrett is, taken by the dacoits and he got sacrificed, and how he didn't resist.
I cannot hear your audio well now. Sorry, that's fine.
Can you hear me now? Did you just hear what I just said?
Now
No.
it's working better.
Okay, so I guess just thinking of also about how Jud Barrett didn't resist at all in terms of when he was being brought to the sacrifice from the dacoits, but then with King Rahugana, he revealed himself. So also about the element of being discerning, or when to defend, when not to defend, when you're able to reveal yourself and when you're not, and but also about the whole notion of being able to remain completely curious and not projecting any of your own internal value judgments onto other devotees when you're relating and trying to connect. So how to relate in a way that is authentic and present, and the acceptance around, difference.
Thank you. One of those easy how-to questions. Not easy, I'm being sarcastic. No, these are, I mean, it's a very important question, a very important concern, but yeah, I will say there are no easy answers in the sense that no easy formulas in that, in the sense of this is the how to. Now this is how to do it, and then you will always succeed, and you will never judge anyone, and you will be impeccable in how you navigate relationships without any assumptions. And we just learn by doing it wrong many times. No, like Father Richard Rohr will say, many times we grow more by doing it wrong than by doing it right. Right? Sometimes we do it right, and we just become complacent. And when we do it wrong, we become humbled by our shortcoming, and it may be a necessary, painful, ongoing reminder that how easy it is to fall into taking the other person for granted, you know? Even taking ourselves for granted, to be honest. I mean, I do that all the time, just entering into public confession mode. It's not easy not to do it. With others and with yourself. No, we tend to put everything in boxes, as we talk many times. As I talk many times and I keep failing miserably about the same thing I'm talking. So that's kind of embarrassing, but that's also part of life, right? That we say, okay, let's not compartmentalize reality, let's not put labels and people in boxes, let's not be carried away by appearances. Let's take time to know in depth who we have in front of us, or even our own self, and in one sense, let's never pronounce any final judgment on anything, because reality remains open. And that sounds very romantic and beautiful, and it is, because that's actual reality. But it's so, I'm talking for me, it's so difficult to remain in a genuine, constant space, childlike space of wonder and curiosity and exploration, and being like really, really intentionally, voluntarily present for the next discovery, Now I'm trying to honor that and to serve that, whatever will come from this situation, from this person, from my own self and potential. It's easier said than done. So I don't think there is like a formula, like with everything, there's no particular formula, but trying to continue to walk that path next time with a little bit more of sincerity, a little bit more of humility, a little bit more of learning from our previous mistake, and that will warranty that the next time the mistake will not be as gross, let's put it that way, as it was the previous time. And we are refining our, we are committing more and more refined mistakes, so to say. till hopefully someday comes where we can genuinely be free from all that, because that's the idea, right? The idea is to reach a point when we genuinely develop a full eye of unconditional loving regard toward everything, willingness, openness. But that's more like, I will say, at least for me, like a long-term goal, because that's the vision of an Uttam Bhagavat, ultimately. That's the vision of the topmost devotee, who is seeing everything with childlike, fresh eyes, seeing the divine present in everything, seeing opportunities for wonder at every pore of creation. So we may really need to be honest about where we are and acknowledge our shortcomings. Or many times our fears also of confronting something that I don't know. So we are meeting, we are about to meet someone that we may not know. And unconsciously, without bad intention, unconsciously we tend to project assumptions. So somehow that gives us some sense of control and certainty. So I put the other person in a box. So I'm not so, I don't have to recognize that I'm actually terrified about meeting someone that I have no clue who that person is. So somehow we judge the person, we put the person in boxes, we ascribe labels. Oh, whew, that gives some sense of control. Ah, it's not entirely unknown. Okay, I can understand that, like a survival mechanism. Again, it's not about like condemning such people, because we do that all the time, most of us. But at least being willing to acknowledge that, and the more we are confronted with the person for who the person actually is, gradually we can leave all those like shields and swords and masks and armors, and be willing for a real encounter with a real person. As we were talking these days here in La Verna, and I mentioned that, right, that today this retreat was with 35 people. So I was a little bit intimidated by the number. I'm not so fond of big groups. And you may think 35 is a big group. Yes, it is for me, or at least for the type of personal connection and intimacy that I want to experience. 35 sounds like a lot. So it was my first time doing a retreat with that amount of people. And on top of that, a quarter of them basically I never met, or I met very briefly. So I was a little bit concerned, will the whole thing, or will the mood be spoiled? Will it be a little complicated? And again, sadly, unconsciously or not, there was some assumption there, some judgment, some fear, if you will. But, and this happened many times to me. So I'm so happy to publicly say that I was proven wrong one more time. And everything went very nicely and smoothly. Not to say that sometimes there can be some accurate intuition about potential trouble, but this time was went very nice. And my point that I want to make is, for example, when some of them that I didn't know were singing in kirtan, were leading kirtan, you get to meet the person in a very vulnerable, open, naked way, and you're like, wow. This was the actual person, not the idea that I had in mind about this person. It's like worlds apart. And one day we had a poetry night, and there was a prompt earlier that day where we invited people to do some contemplation in connection to nature and write a poem. And if they felt like it, share it in the poetry night we had. And so many wrote poems, and so many were willing to share the poems openly, which again is a very courageous act. And again, you are seeing these wonderful people sharing what they wrote, their realizations and reflections and their poetry. And I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't have a clue that you are such a marvel, so to say, and you know, even if I was not thinking bad about you, again, even if I was not offending them, I was not fully loving them for the lovers that they were. Right, so I needed to be exposed to that degree of, and we all need generally to really meet the other person for who the other person actually is, and hopefully we can craft spaces intentionally so that happens. Now, I think it's important for us to consciously create moments so we can give each other the chance to really show up for who we are. Not only for the person to have that opportunity, oh, I can try to be myself, but also for everyone else to witness the person for who they actually are and stop projecting their own ideas about who they think the person actually is. So it's a great opportunity in every direction. Sometimes will be scary and terrifying and difficult, but it's so needed. And that's such a humbling moment, not to say humiliating moment, at least for me, when you realize, wow, I had such a narrow version and idea about that person, super reductionistic in my mind. And now I'm seeing like, I'm seeing so much more that even I know it's not the whole thing, but I have a glimpse of the actual noble heart behind my idea about that person that is like completely different. So sometimes we learn by that. We learn by, like, again, Father Richard Rohr will say he daily will pray for, he prays for one daily humiliation from God. God, send me one humiliation per day so I can really remain grounded, right? I can be brought back to reality, because generally I tend to put people in boxes, assumptions, and we do not contact reality, as you were saying, your question for what it actually is, right? So I think that those are some ways we can try to do that. And again, I will emphasize not only regards to others, but many times in regards to ourselves. Many times we underestimate our potential. We put ourselves in boxes very often, way smaller than the boxes we put other people, and we start to suffocate in those boxes. And many times we need to, be taken outside of the box, which means being taken outside of the box we have put ourselves into, and we are suffocating there. So we can see ourselves from another perspective. Sometimes that may need to be mirrored by other brothers and sisters, so they mirror back our potential, and I can like leave my old assumptions about who I think I am, because this could be one of the most deadly forms of arrogance, let's put it that way, to be certain about who I think I am. And nobody can tell me who I am because I am myself. So who knows better than myself who I am? How many times we have no clue who we are, and we are completely identified with a very tiny, suffocated, very ungenerous version of ourselves that we have crafted in our mind. And sometimes we need someone else to mirror back a way bigger version of our own self. So that's Sadhusanga at the end of the day for me. That's what Sadhusanga is for. It's like entering a hall of mirrors, but a hall of mirrors of potential. Not a hall of mirrors just reflecting back your own tiny version where you put yourself in the little box. That would be the madhouse, right? But if you are full of mirrors, no, because sometimes you have these places, maybe you've seen, we have gone there to this, like, I don't know, like a circus, not a circus, but these places you go and there are mirrors that deform you and they show you like with a head bigger and like, ugh. So we have all those inside of our own mind, right? We don't need even more of those outside. So we need to enter into a hall of mirrors with, rather than deforming who we actually are actually showing an actual real reflection of who we are. And we in the beginning may not believe it because we may have identified with a deformed reflection of that terror house that our mind has become at times. So when someone shows you a real picture of who you are, in the beginning may be unbelievable. It's like, no, that's not me. I know who I am. I'm this deformed creature that I've been living with for this long time. It's, no, that's not who you are. That mirror is not working. That's a distorted circus mirror or whatever, horror movie mirror. here is a real mirror, boom. No, and sadhu comes and shows you a reflection of your potential and what to do when we see that. Whether we run away horrified, we kill the person we show in that mirror, we hopefully become moved to tears and realize, wow, that's who I really am. Wow, that's a way better version. There's so much waiting there and embracing our potential gradually and releasing our assumptions and judgments and ideas we had about ourselves. That's not so easy. That's kind of the probably the most heroic form of renunciation. At the end of the day, renunciation is not so much about renouncing things, but about renouncing ideas and ways of seeing things. And it starts generally with ways of seeing ourselves. And renouncing that, releasing that version that somehow I've lived with for my whole life, and somehow I felt it's giving life to myself. Releasing that is a form of death, and daring to step into new life. So I don't know how much this all is with Jada Bharat. I hope I'm somehow keeping myself on track and honoring your question. But you tell me, Manjula Manjari.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I could identify a lot with that. I found it very helpful, the whole way of mirroring. So thank you.
Yeah. And again, one more thing that comes to my mind going for a minute to the story you mentioned, of course, is we see a lot of taking people for granted in that story, right? I mean, the dacoits take for granted Jada Bharat, the people working for King Rahugana, when they capture Jada Bharat, they take him for granted. Rahugana takes him for granted. In the sense of they judge him, they put him in a box. This guy is like a brute. He doesn't have much intelligence, but he has good muscles. So let's employ him for our purpose. So very utilitarian and very just hyper-reductionistic, reducing the person to objectifying the person. No, you became an object for what I need, and you are no more than that. Which unfortunately, that's many times how we treat each other. Even though we may not dare to confess, but many times we filter relationships in terms of what's to my advantage here. And of course we need to rise above that. But eventually, of course, the moral of the story is when Jada Bharat shows himself for who he is, King Rahugana can see that, can appreciate Jada Bharat in its actual truth and its actual and in his actuality. But then that mirrors back onto him, right? So King Rahugana then becomes, so to say, enlightened by the words of Jada Bharat after appreciating who he is, and that reflects back onto Rahugana to realize, okay, not only now I'm appreciating who you actually are, Jada Bharat, now I'm starting to have a glimpse of who I am actually, I myself. The bells are sounding here in the back in La Verna. So seems that St. Francis is happy with our answer here. But yeah, I wanted to refer back that a little bit to the Leela of the Bhagavatam you refer to, which is a very important one. And shows how, again, when we stop putting people into boxes, assuming we know who they are, and we open ourselves to actually contacting the real person, I mean, we may find our guru there. We may find guru there. And that guru principle, even in someone we may not expect, will always reflect back, shed light on who we actually are, so we can release our outdated versions, ideas about ourselves, and embrace a newer, updated, upgraded possibility. So again, it's a gradual process. Trail, failure, learning, falling upward, continuing the walk. That's the beauty and the messiness of the sadhaka's journeys, we would like to say. So thank you. Thank you, Manjula Manjari, for the question. And
Thank you very
well,
much.
we invite you one more time to our breakout room for a few minutes. Then we will attend the questions from Gauracharana Tapana Nandini, and then Divyangana is also raising her hand. So see you back in a few moments. There you are. Welcome back. Hoping you had a nourishing time, whether in your breakout rooms or those who spend some time by themselves, with yourselves, probably trying to shed some old assumptions about yourself and trying to rediscover ourselves. Hopefully, all of you had some revealing moments. So let's continue. We have two more raised digital hands, which I think will make up for today. And the next one, following the original order, is from Gorcharan, Tapan, and Nandini. And it's, yeah, quite big. Tapan and Nandini, Gorcharan is pointing. So it's quite bizarre to know that you were here with us today in the morning and now you are over there on the other side. So, yeah, when I saw Manjwalia, so that background is her house, but how is she in her house? Oh, yeah, she traveled early in the morning. And the same with Jamuna, but the same with Tapan and Nandini. No, happy to know that you arrived safe and well back home. So, welcome, Tapan and Nandini.
Well, I can really relate to Manjulali's being terrified asking questions because I never have on here before, and I've been here quite a long time now. And I think being at the Laverna retreat has really helped. Other than or otherwise, I'm just pumped up on coffee to try and get Manjulali and Jamuna home, which we managed, and I'm can't even write properly now. But a question came up. During the retreat, and actually just talking now with Kanapriya and Martin, who's just new here and wants to know how to join more of this. So it's wonderful to see him from Holland. But Maurice, you were talking about how matter is important and sacred, and everything's coming from Krishna, you know, all the emotions. And I just wondered about how unawareness and ignorance, avidya, fits into that. That is that coming from Krishna? It's probably a question you've asked, been answered many times. So, but it's wondering about.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Again, welcome back over there, and thank you for daring to take the mic. Yeah. So if everything comes from Krishna, how to does avidya or ignorance or unawareness come from Krishna? Which is somehow it's a long topic, but sometimes comes this type of things. Okay, Krishna is described in the scriptures as Sarva Karana Karanam, no? Like Brahma Samhita, for example, Ishvara Parama Krishna, Sachidananda Vigraha, Anadir Adir Govinda, Sarva Karana Karanam. Krishna is the cause of all causes. So that's a delicate line because with that line you can just like sweep away all free will and everything because Krishna is the cause of all causes. So whatever is happening, it's ultimately him doing that, which is not accurate. It's a very like sentimental way to understand that line, a very inaccurate way, you know, like okay, behind everything, he's the actual one doing everything. So at the end of the day, you are not doing anything, you have no free will, and that creates its own problems that we have talked about many times. So I'm connecting this in the sense of okay, everything comes from Krishna, right? He's the source of everything. Which, if we understand it in a very simplistic way, again, it ends up falling onto him. He's responsible for whatever is happening. I don't know, maybe you have heard recently there was a big, very devastating earthquake in Venezuela, among other places as well. There have been like five earthquakes at the same time during that day. But the most devastating one was in Venezuela with thousands of people dead. And so far, I think like 30,000 disappeared people who have not been found yet, which in one sense meant most of them maybe are probably dead as well. So these are delicate situations, right? And again, if we play out this idea, okay, Krishna is the cause of all causes, we will end up concluding with the dangerous idea that, oh, he actually created that earthquake and he. For some higher purpose, because he's a cause behind all causes, right? But that's not the idea. There are different ways to speak about causality. I don't want to enter now into all the technicalities of it, but there are instrumental causes, ultimate causes, this cause, that cause. So when we say that Krishna is the cause of everything or the source of everything, we are never saying that in the sense that things did not exist and start to exist at some point, because we talk about anadi, anadi avidya. You are asking about avidya, right? Ignorance or unawareness. And the scriptures say that's anadi, which means that has no beginning. No. So in one sense, that's not caused. It's not that it didn't exist and Krishna pressed the button and now there is avidya and he's the cause of that. Now, he's the cause of everything in the sense of being the sustain, the base, the foundation, the ground, the source. But again, the source of something that has no beginning, which then we have to use paradoxical language. But God is the ultimate sustain and unit and maintainer of everything. But again, everything exists without beginning. At least that's our philosophy, right? God exists eternally along with his shaktis, his potencies, material energy, bhakti energy, Swarup Shakti, us as a unique form of energy. We are not caused in time. So when we say Krishna is the cause, doesn't mean that we are being caused by him at some point. So it's mostly to make the point of God is the ultimate reality, and everything is sustained on that. But that doesn't cancel the fact that there is free will, for example. And in that free will, we happen to have free will. Again, it's not that Krishna programmed the soul. Okay, I'm deciding that the souls will have free will. And part of having free will is the opportunity for avidya and unawareness enter. And then trouble starts. Right? So it's what it is. We exist eternally. Love exists eternally, as we say always. And love is voluntary. So for us to choose love, we need to have free will, and free will must entail more than one choice. And the two choices, or more than two, have to be different enough for them to be genuine choices and not exactly the same. And that's the paradox, right? Love is the ultimate reality. Everything is inviting to love, but love requires volition, agency, decision, free, voluntary. And that entails the possibility of choosing something else. And that's avidya, that's an awareness, and that's what brings us into trouble. And going back, for example, I know this is another topic, and I actually will be speaking about that in a few days in Zurich, because I have one program there and I was invited. I assume Kanupriya from Switzerland is a little bit to blame for the topic. So if you like the topic, blame her. Because it's a topic that we always talked about, free will, karma, evil in the world. And to these days I was reflecting, because my upcoming book has its longest chapter on that. Okay, God is all merciful, all loving. What about evil? What about suffering? How to explain that? And I was thinking about this notion that we have in our tradition of the kleshas, or the, if you want to translate that as miseries or distresses, which are divided in three, right? Adhyatmika klesha, adi daivika klesha, adi bhautika klesha, which basically means the distress that comes from our own selves, from other beings, and from phenomena, nature. Phenomenon, nature calamities, if you will. So it's interesting that these three departments are there, because for me, in one way, the fact that they are divided into these three is a way of saying these three have their own agency. And therefore, by interacting with that, the risk, the potential risk, there will be trouble. Like, you have your own agency, you can create adhyatmika klesha. You can be a misery to yourself, so to say. By interact adi bhautika klesha, by interacting with other living beings, they have their own agency. There's the possibility of distress. And nature has its own agency as well. Now, let's not forget that nature is its own person. It's not just like an impersonal thing. And it has to move accordingly to what it requires, and that of course may exceed our understanding that how an earthquake can be necessary. And there are many ways that one could, I'm not trying to justify earthquakes and the calamities it bring, but many times those things are from the bigger picture movements of tectonic shifts. Tectonic shifts in nature are necessary for creating the necessary cycles for preservation and sustenance, but part of that is the terrible results it causes. Recently, we did a podcast with Tamal Krishna in Spanish. And we're talking about that, how we need to confront the feminine, which entails nature, among other things, in both its beauty and charm, but also in both in its terrible face. No? Because let's not be naive about it. There are aspects of nature which are terrible. Not as something bad, that's something that shouldn't happen, but it's what it is. And then you have the images of the goddess. From one side, you have Radha or Lakshmi, very, very calm, very tender. And then you have Kali, like with mouth out and drinking, sometimes there are images of her cutting her own head with her own head in the hand and blood spilling from his neck, and the head cut off is drinking the blood. So it's like, wow. No? So it's kind of bringing us to there's a terrible side to the feminine. And that has to be dealt with and properly integrated into its integration of polarities. It's not, I just want the calm, gentle, comfortable, sweet version of the mother. Mother can be terrible, but not because something bad. That's my point. No? Because it's a necessary aspect into the dynamics of nature, all devouring for recreation, no? Not recreation like play, by creating again, right? Cycles, no? That from a small vision seems like this shouldn't be happening, but from the bigger picture, it's a necessary movement, but it devours, so to say, creates tragedy. So I think there are no easy answer for any of the things I'm talking about, but I think it's important to be willing to talk about the things from that way. So, and your question on obedience and awareness is, again, it's not like God is causing obedience, but it's just the unavoidable implications of existing as we are as a unit of free will. So if I have free will, I have choices, and one choice is to love, and the other choice to reduce them to two. Is basically to not be aware of that reality, and that's when avidya comes into play. Now, if we want to speak about Krishna or God Himself being possessed of avidya or unawareness, that's another, we have to talk from another side, because again, we are not God, at least from our tradition's perspective. So we will say God is not unaware, He's omniscient. Of course, at the same time, God's omniscience, that's another conversation, right? It's nuanced because it's not, I will say, not every Gaudiya Vaishnava will say what I will say, but some will say what I will say, which is God doesn't know the future in the ultimate detail and what will actually happen, but knows in perfect detail all the possibilities that exist in potential. But then there's something remains open. Because if you know everything in advance, there is no possibility for wonder and surprise. And the tradition says, Rasa vai saha, Taittiriya Upanishad. This is a very main line for us. Brahman, the absolute, is rasa, or sacred rapture. That's an interesting way to talk about God, right? Who is God? Sacred rapture. And then scriptures say, rasa sar chamatkar. And the essence of rasa, of that sacred rapture, is chamatkar, or astonishment, wonder. So the essence of the absolute is ongoing wonder. So if you make God absolutely omniscient and knows everything in detail in advance, there's no place for any type of wonder. So in that sense, there is some type of ignorance, if you want to use that word, or not full awareness, even in God, not in the same way as it is in us. It's an unawareness always from a fully enlightened perspective. On top of that, we can also talk about the sacred ignorance that we see in Krishna in his Lila in Vrindavan, when he is so much overwhelmed by the love of his devotees that he becomes, in one sense, he loses sight of the fact that he's God, put it in some way. It's a charming ignorance, right? It's a very interesting one. So there are many ways we can ascribe ignorance to God, but again, in a way that is just, it's an ignorance that facilitates the a deeper exchange of love. So how much we can call that ignorance, you decide. But it's not the same ignorance that in our case prevents from a deeper approach to love. So there are different forms of knowing and not knowing. We are always aware of something, and that makes us unaware of something else. So in our case, many times we are aware of things that are just a distorted picture, and we are unaware of the real picture of love. In the case of God, he is so aware of love that he becomes unaware of his being God. That's a very interesting theological point. So his unawareness in the context of love. So it's a holy one. Generally, our unawareness is in another context. When we become advanced, enlightened, if you will embrace a sacred form of unknowing. We will lose a gyan sunya bhakti, we will call in our tradition, a type of devotion where when you empty yourself of knowledge, even of the fact that Krishna is God, and you start seeing Radha and Krishna in terms not of God and goddess, but in terms of familiarity and intimacy and a personal loving relationship. So there's lots of ignorance in eternity, but it's the ignorance that comes from love. Again, in that case, we can say ignorance is bliss. We need to ignore certain things in eternity to taste a certain unique bliss that comes only by ignoring that Krishna is God, for example. There's some bliss available when you know that God is God, and there's another quality of bliss available when you forget that God is God. You choose, pick your bliss or pick your ignorance. You can pull it. Anyhow, so few thoughts. I don't know if that helps.
I know it really helps. Thank you, Maharaj. Just reminder that, the unavoidable implication of our free will and agency, that's, I just look forward to being in ignorant bliss. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we'll skip one breakout room as we usually do to keep time in its place, and so we can also properly honor the offering that any of you may have. We have one more last raised digital hand, this in this case coming from Divyangana from Dijon, I assume. I don't know where you are. I mean, I know you live there, but I don't know if you're in Dijon now. So yeah, from Dijon,
Yes.
France.
Yes, we
Welcome.
are indeed. Yeah,
Welcome,
thank you.
welcome.
Hare Krishna. Yes, actually, I had one question. I don't know it exactly from which side, but I really appreciate when we speak about. I know you already speak about this, about aparad, and how sometimes one of the biggest aparad we do is against ourselves. Because I can personally be extremely cruel with myself in the self-talk. And also, I'll be honest, like I feel like in my life I'm facing a lot of limitation inside myself. Many, many things I feel limited in as a human, that as the things that I can do. Sometimes I just don't understand what is the purpose of my life. I feel useless, and I don't understand. So I don't know. I guess there is both a lot of two aspects to this question, but I think yes, there is. I think there is a part of it like I realize it's an offense when you are very hard with yourself, and at the same time, sometimes you feel so limited that you feel like, okay, but why am I here? Why did you send me here? Like I just feel like I'm trapped. I'm here, but I don't know why I'm here. I feel like I'm good for nothing. And yeah, sorry if it's not very clear.
I'll share some words about that, yeah, if you allow me. Yeah, thank you. Well, thank you, first of all, for sharing vulnerably and having the courage of sharing with us that at times you feel like that, maybe more often than at times. And as usually, I like to begin saying that you are not alone in that. You're not the only person on earth feeling that. You're not the person probably in this group feeling that. So it's a common human experience as to feel limited, because we are in many ways, at least, yeah, for some time of the journey, we will be more aware of our limitations than our brightest potential. So that to begin with, right? You are not alone in that. So I think that's important, because if the problem, as I always say, many times the real problem is that we isolate ourselves in our own shortcomings, in our own limitations, that we put ourselves in that box. I am the only one feeling that. I am the worst of the worst, or whatever. And that's not true. That's not true. I agree with you when we speak about apparat, when we speak about going against love, what to speak of acting cruelly or in a hating way. Many times we are ourselves the main target of that. And many times, rather than focusing on not offending others or not hating others, we have to begin at home. And as Bhaktivinoda Thakur say, when he speaks about apparat, he subdivides apparat in four, and one of those is jiva apparat. No? Not Vaishnava apparat is there, jiva apparat is there, and in our case, we are both jiva and Vaishnava. So we should not engage in that. No? Of course, it's delicate, because sometimes we realize we are committing apparat to ourselves, and then we feel even worse about knowing we are offending ourselves, and then we start to hate ourselves even more. So it can be like a downward spiral, right? I hate myself, or I'm not gentle with myself. I do not love myself enough, and therefore I realize that, and I start to whip myself even harder because of that. And that's not the idea. I know it for some of us, it may not be easy to stop the whipping, and that's why we need to have other people near our lives so we can connect, and they can be, as I say before, reminders and mirrors that we have purpose, we have meaning, we are not useless. And of course, if we feel that, then we have to learn to sit with those questions. Why do I feel useless? Because you are not useless. Nobody's useless. Nobody's useless. But we can feel useless, that's for sure. I mean, I think that's a, if there's something that marks our common human shared journeys, that at some point in our life we have felt useless. Raise your hand, those who never have felt that. If you have never felt that, it's okay, we'll give you an award. But you can see nobody's raising their hand. So that's part of what it means to travel the human journey. At some time you will feel useless. That doesn't mean you are. That's when it comes to this discernment. What I think, what I feel, even doesn't mean it's true. So the question is, where is this coming from? Where is this anartha coming from? Anartha means a false belief. Where is this false belief, false assumptions, as we were talking before? Where is this false value coming from? And many times, again, it comes from childhood trauma, certain lackings in connection with our parents, some experience of abuse or trauma. It may come even from previous life. Maybe too much for us to think about previous life. We have enough for with this one. So we may need sometimes to, with proper support and love and care, to sit with those questions, because if not, we may be just contacting the symptoms of the actual problem. I feel useless. Okay, we don't want to deny that. I mean, we don't want to deny that one feels that, but we want to deny that you are useless. I want to deny that you are useless, because you are not useless, but I don't want to downplay that one may be feeling that, but still, that's the symptom. That's not the actual problem. That's a symptom of what makes me feel like that. So we may need to go beyond the symptom and explore where is this coming from, speaking about source. And sometimes that journey is complicated. Sometimes we will need professional support and guidance in traveling those turbulent inner waters. There may be, yeah, things that may be intense to witness and to acknowledge and to name and to frame. But the moment we start to do all that with more clarity, we start to recover the power. We start to reclaim our own voice, and we can clearly see the difference between what I think I am and who I actually am. So, as you can see, I'm not giving any easy answer. I don't have here like the magical formula that solves the whole world's problems, because if that will exist, we will be in paradise, and clearly we are not. So we all have to do our homework. So I think it's important, and it's very foundational, to over and over go back on a daily basis, all the times we need, to this idea. Okay, one may say, okay, I know in theory that I'm not useless. Okay, I get the idea, but I feel useless. Okay. And I cannot just erase that emotion at that moment. And okay, I have to ask myself what's behind that. I'll try, but sometimes that comes. Okay. So maybe try it in that moment, and I'm not telling this to you like personal counseling advice, Dibyangana. It's just for all of us, starting with Swami Padmanabha. In those moments where you feel the worst, try to invoke something even more powerful, because I know it's quite powerful, the feeling of worthlessness. But on top of that, there is always something more powerful, which is on top of all that you are feeling or you think you are, Krishna is loving you unconditionally. You're already seen, you're already held, you're already loved. And try to enter that space. Try to invoke something more powerful to our own sense of worthlessness, which is, I'm being accepted as I am. Even if I dare to believe I'm useless, you are being infinitely loved by Krishna. So, of course, how Krishna can love infinitely something that is useless? No, I mean, if he's loving something, he's loving everything, which basically means nothing is useless. And still, the idea, okay, of entering into that space where Krishna loves me unconditionally may be a little bit difficult or sound abstract. And that's why, again, we need to meet the embodied expression of Krishna's love. It's going back to the beginning of our conversation, right? The lovers of love, those who embody love, and who can give us a very tangible experience. You are seen, you are held, you are loved, you are not useless, you are a unit of worth and value. And that person can really tell us and listen to us, be there with us, accept us unconditionally. We all need such people in our life. And for us, that's Sadhu Sangha. For us, that's the meaning of organizing these weekly gatherings, right? I mean, there's no ulterior motive or agenda. Okay, every Saturday we are doing this because we are getting so many donations by doing this every Saturday. We are gaining some government support or Nobel Prize. Nothing at all. The real wealth is the chance of meeting with each other, seeing each other, being for each other, witnessing each other, supporting each other. Some days one will be in need, the other will be in need, supporting, giving support, receiving support. And again, simultaneously trying to heal, trying to work. Meanwhile, we are doing spiritual practice. Many of us will need to, as part of the spiritual practice, we'll need to do deep, profound healing on the emotional, psychological, human dimension. It's not antithetical or opposite to bhakti. And sometimes of our journey, we may need to pay special attention to that dimension more than in another parts of the journey, depending on what's required. But that's what I will say. And at the same time, not want to sound that I'm giving any easy answers, because again, there are no real answers, are never easy answers. And there are different levels of this. What's the per you asked, you mentioned, you were wondering, what's the purpose in my life? And women need to go back to that question so many times in a lifetime. I cannot tell you how many times I asked that question to myself, which doesn't mean that the previous answers that I found to those questions were useless. It means that they have been outgrown. They have become outdated. They worked till one point. Now I need a new level of answer. So it's not that because I keep having this question, it means that I'm useless or nothing is working or I'm doing everything wrong. No, it's just that the previous version of myself has done its duty. And now it can be, how to say, honorably discharged. And we are ready to discover ourselves in a new version. And for that purpose, we may need to ask the same question again. Who am I? What's the purpose of my life? Someone will say, but you were doing those questions on day one, that when you joined the movement and they gave you the replies to that, you should now be asking new questions. Now, who say that? Tell them that if they ask you that. Tell them that. So I probably say, who said that? We can go back to those questions over and over again. No? When Sanatana Goswami first met Mahaprabhu, his first question was, who am I and why I'm suffering? That's Sanatana Goswami, okay? So he didn't come with this super esoteric inquiry. It's like, who am I? I can always ask that question. I can always get something new from that question. This day in this retreat, in the first day of getting to know each other, we were 35, so many of us didn't know each other. So we organized like different circles with, I don't know, six, five people. And there was a prompt, or supposedly there were going to be many prompts. And I heard that Tapan and Nandini spoiled the prompt. Yes, you did it. Why? Because the first question was, who are you? So everyone replied, and then it came the turn for the second question. And Tapan and Nandini said, I already know what's the second question because Maharaj says that all the time in the class, right? It's okay. I spoil it by saying it in my class. So the second question is, who are you? And then the third question is, who are you? And then you are just going over and over again, and there's always something new to say. So my point is, we can always ask this question, who am I? What's the purpose of my life? It doesn't mean that we are necessarily lost, nothing has a purpose, I'm worthless and useless. It means like I'm trying to find new depth. No? I'm trying to find new depth. What has taken me so far on the journey is glorious and I'm honoring that, but I'm thirsty for a new level of depth. And I need to ask that question again. And I need to be in a crisis one more time. Because when you ask the same question, it means previous answers no longer work. So it's a form of crisis. Like you need to find a new version of yourself, a new form of meaning in life. It's not bad. That's how you pro how we progress. We progress through crisis. So I'm just saying all this so you can hopefully appreciate that. I'm not saying that nothing needs to be healed or worked on, but also appreciating many of the things that can be actually a sign of growth and progress. And sometimes we just stamp them as this shouldn't be happening. This is a proof that I'm wrong, that I'm doing offenses, that I'm not having enough faith because I'm asking the same question because I don't know what's the purpose of my life. And probably that's the best possible question you can ask in this moment. Again, I'm talking in general. We are not having like a private personal conversation about the details of the situation that could happen in another space. But yeah, in general, I will say that. yeah, you are not useless. Not at all. Not at all. I mean, nobody of us is useless at all. We are in the eyes of Krishna. I'm sorry to repeat myself all over, but we need to hear this so many times. We are wonderful. That's what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. No, you are amazing, you are marvelous, you are beautiful. He doesn't have time to say you are not useless. No, he has to go straight to the point. You are wonderful. No? You are beautiful. You are marvelous. So the next question is, what do I do with that? God is telling me in my face that I'm wonderful three times. Do I believe him or not? Do I believe in God? Believe in God means to believe God, right? To believe what God is telling me. Krishna tells me you're wonderful. I say I don't believe that. Then one says we are not believing in Krishna. So we have to believe in Krishna, which means we have to believe what Krishna is telling to us, to each one of our hearts, which is he's longing for us. He's longing for the contact with each one of us. So we are being longed for by the most important person in creation. How can one be useless? No. We are being seen, we are being considered, we are being so many words we could use. But Krishna is very, very concerned in a loving way for each one of us. So, and again, not only Krishna. It's not just keeping that between you and God. There are so many other people. I know I'm talking without giving names, but I'm sure I'm talking for all of these people present, beautiful people present today. As much as I know most of you, I trust that we care for each other to one degree or another. So immediately that proves that we are not useless. No. One will be useless. There will be no place for you here. Nobody will pay you attention, answer anything, blah, blah, blah. And even if sometimes some people treat you that way, that doesn't mean you are useless either. No. We need to return over and over again there. And I'm not feeling ashamed if we feel those ways. Again, it's part of the journey. Someday I wake up feeling miserable, feeling ashamed of myself, feeling that I'm a failure to creation or whatever. The important thing is to have the courage that you just had and expressing that, voicing that openly. That in itself is a way of taking it out from our own head and taking that narrative, that voice, blah, 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 boom, putting it out and turning down the volume of that and hopefully seeing that for what it is and seeing that, no, that's a voice over there. I'm something different. And every time we need that reminder, Shastra is there to remind us that. Sadhusanga is there to remind us that. And that's why we want to create together a community of brothers and sisters that can be available at all times to remind each other what we need to hear at any given moment. Because we can be at an emergency case, emergency moment at any moment. We never know how life can surprise us or how we may find ourselves, who knows where. So it's good to know we have some bases covered, at least in the form of people that will have loving support and wise words to be there for us with intention and care. So I will say you have those people in your life, so you are fortunate and you're blessed, and we all are. So few words. Dear Dibyangana, I hope it helps in some way.
No, yeah, actually, it's very good. Just remind myself, I have a quote from you on my wall. It say, "Order, disorder, reorder," and I think it really helps. Yeah, I think it really helps to understand that all these little small crises or everything is a natural process, and it can be also very have a positive outcome, as you said. So it's a It's very, very good to be reminded, actually.
Good that you have it on your wall. It's Father Richard Rohr's quote. I'm just quoting
Yeah.
him, but yeah. Look at your wall more often. Walls have a purpose. Sometimes walls divide. But walls can also be a mirror and remind us of what we need to be reminded of. Even if we are in the eye of the storm, it's always important to remind us this won't last forever. And we have gone through so many of those turbulent chapters, and here we are. We'll continue to grow and to bloom. But sometimes we need to enter into the disorder chapter it's a necessary chaos that we may not fully understand, but at least during those moments, doing the right things as much as we can, being in the right company, and eventually we'll move through the tunnel. There's light at the end of the tunnel, and we will look back and realize, wow, that was such a gift. Maybe in the form of a wound, maybe in the form of some complexity to be integrated, but and sometimes we won't understand the purpose of it in the eye of the storm. So we have to trust the storm and trust the disorder as part of the reorder. It doesn't end up in disorder. It's always for a further expansion of our heart and experience. So yeah. Keep looking at that wall. Looks important. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank
Okay.
you.
Dear friends, dear family, well, let's go one more time to our breakout rooms to put our session to rest and to reflect together a little bit about this perennial inquiry, not only from the Dibhyangana, from all of us, in terms of continuing to find meaning and purpose and navigating worthlessness in a healthy way, in connection with conditional love and the support we require. So you will be sent to the digital chambers of Zoom for a few minutes and see you back for our final goodbye of the day. Hey, Pranam, welcome back. Hoping you had some nourishing, moving sharing, giving us hope and support in our daily journey. So thanks so much for being there for one another, for me as well. Hopefully I can be there for you as well in reciprocation. So we will put our sharing to rest for today. Praying to be blessed on this coming week, this coming day, this coming hour and minute, every breath, every step we take, do it in the context of blessedness. Thank you so much for your presence and attention and quests and exploration. And see you next week. Sriman Mahaprabhu Ki Jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan Ki Jai, Samaveda Bhaktavrinda Ki Jai. From over here, we say St. Francis Ki Jai. Alverna ki jai, all the dhams ki jai, Gaur Premanand
Ribo.
Haribo, Vancha Kalpadubhyascha Kripasindu Pyaiva Cha, Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah.